Okay, friends. Rain or shine, or snow, or sadness, we're going to learn. Okay. Our final installment for the semester, Fundamentals, is, appropriately, what was my clever title? Only Atheists Can Pray. Ah, I like it.
Interesting.
It cuts to the core. What do you think, Jared?
Sounds interesting.
So, I want to review with you about 500 or 600 years worth of medieval debates about prayer, philosophical debates on prayer. But that's boring. Why don't we change the dynamic to what is it you think that people have, what difficulties do people have with tefillah? What would keep somebody from davening? What would make davening more difficult? Besides, like, you know. No, not besides the obvious, including the obvious.
What if you don't believe in God? It'd be like, who are you praying to?
Belief in God's definitely going to be a thorny one.
Somebody, if you feel you don't have the time, maybe?
Time? Or, you know, we can even change it like, what's up with three times a day? Let's even push that, because, like, for asking God for something, isn't once a day enough? Like, what does God want us, like, in the gym, or what's going on?
Maybe, like, language, like, it's not understanding the Hebrew.
Language barrier. Once led a March of Living trip, and it was almost like completely secular, like the cohort. And I was a trip rabbi, so one of the like the functions of the trip rabbi is basically to say Kaddish everywhere in Poland. Like, okay, there's a bus stop, time to say Kaddish, kind of thing. Like everything's a Jewish cemetery. So I'm exaggerating. So the first time I didn't know like what to do because, you know, I want to involve people, but I don't know how familiar people were with like various mourning things. So I wanted to say a psalm, like a Kapitel Tehillim. And, we all had in our name tags, we had like a little, pullout sheet, and the pullout sheet had Psalm, what's it, 130, Shir LaMaalot. In Hebrew and in English. And I said to myself, okay, that's nice. Well, I'll say Shir LaMaalot together. Yeah. And I'll say Kaddish. But I was like, wait, you know, I don't think most people here know how to read Hebrew, which I was completely correct about. So I'll say it in English. It's like, you know, because the truth is that Hebrew, English, God could understand both languages, turns out. So we said, you know, a song of ascents. I would raise mine eyes above the hills. And anyway, after we did that, this was our first stop, this was the Warsaw Ghetto. One of the like most secular guys came up to me and was like, Rabbi, we're never doing that again. That was the most reformed thing I've ever done in my life. It's like, oh, okay, so we did it.
Yeah.
That was it. Maybe we just didn't say Tillam anymore? I don't know. Anyway, language barrier. What can I tell you? We would daven more in English if it wasn't for the reform movement. But everyone feels weird. Okay, what else? I'll tell you something that gets me. It's about this. Look, let's say I believe in God. Let's say it's not I don't believe in God. Let's say I do believe in God. So then there's certain things I believe about God, right? God has my best interest in mind.
Mm-hmm.
God knows all. God knows better than me, right?
Why do you need to pray God?
Right. Well, we say this all the time when bad things happen. I mean, we try to not say this to people because it can often sound stupid and backfire, but, you know, you don't want to walk up to someone in the middle of a tragedy and be like, it's for the best. Don't worry. He was supposed to die. It's for the best. We don't say that, but you know, when the emotional stakes are low, we say that all the time. We say that God knows best, right? Mm-hmm. So emotional six, let's say, you get a flat tire. So part of you is really upset, and part of you says, like, it's for a reason. It's for a reason, right? Why the heck do we say it's for a reason? Because God knows all, God's all powerful, and God has my best interest in mind. Because God is all good, right? We have the funky formula. God is all good plus all knowing plus all powerful. So once you have those three things in mind, and this is the opposite of this one. Like, on the one hand, if you don't believe in God, then who are you praying to? Or if you're not sure that God's there, it seems like a waste of effort, on the one hand. On the other hand, if you really believe in God, it's definitely a waste of effort. No question. Except for the fact that God told us to pray. Why? If God already knows. We're asking, right? Prayer is about asking God for things. So it's just like, it's also a waste of time. So now God commanded me to waste my time?
Yeah.
It's very strange. Right, so I'd say this is an issue if we're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, Rabia? It doesn't have to, but if it does, might as well throw it up on the board.
Just because there's like different types. Like, the prayers is, like, very exact, like, what you're supposed to do. Or maybe just the structure around such a spiritual...
Overly structured. Yeah. There is room, even in our structured tefillah, for flexibility and for innovation in certain parts I could tell you about. But you're absolutely right. Even with whatever innovative areas I can... produce for you, the reality is that, you know, there's a sitter, and most of the stuff is written down already. So what are you going to do? Okay. J-Rad, you got anything?
I was thinking, like, maybe, like, going
besides
into
besides that fine sweater?
Thank you. I was thinking maybe you might, in maybe certain context, there's a belief in God, but maybe you may believe in God, but he thinks that after he created the world, that he left everything to it, and he doesn't interfere in our lives. So then you think, consequently, why should I pray to God? Because it's not going to do anything.
Awesome. Back to the philosophy of God, right? You have this, you're like stuck between deism and what's it when God controls everything? It's
Judaism.
No. Yes, kind of. No. Well, Judaism is a space is in the tension between the two, when everything's foretold and everything's predestined.
Oh, predestination.
Is that the word I'm looking for?
It's when you
determinism.
Yeah.
Predestination is a correct word. Determinism is the philosophy that says that there's no free will, because God's already called all the shots. You don't actually have to be a theist to believe in determinism. You can also think that after the Big Bang, the whole universe is basically a big billiard table. One atom hits the other atom, and that atom hits another atom, and that atom hits another atom. And if you zoom out a little bit, that's our brain. Right, all of our decisions are just atoms bumping up against each other, neuron synapses. I'm basically, everything I'm doing now was the shots were called at the time of the Big Bang, right? It just exploded, and the atoms continued to bump into each other until they eventually run out of steam. So that's determinism, or you could just think that God called all the shots. Either way, you're stuck in the same place. And then deism is like, there's no God. We're just like in the space of ourselves. You know, God made the world. Step back. Okay, so how do we navigate this in the context of prayer? Prayer, which seems like this opportunity to communicate with God and to express our needs and have them fulfilled. So, number one thing always, whenever something's confusing, you have to define your terms. So, we took for granted, well, define prayer for me.
Well, if I were to define prayer, there is a, I remember when I was in Israel, I learned there are three aspects when you might, when you pray that you should think, you should concentrate on, that
Jared, are getting too complicated.
No, but I think it could contribute to this definition.
Okay.
One, you ask, you try to be an asker, you ask, you're asking God for something.
Okay.
Two, you're trying to connect with God, establish a relationship with God.
That's nice, I like that.
And three, you're trying to, when you pray, you're trying to, like, submit to His will. At the same
Submission. Islam.
Well, it's not in the Islamic context. It's different in the sense that, like, the way that the rabbis told me is like, if it be your will, oh God, please give me this. So it's kind of somewhat submission.
It's no knock. Like, there's some nice things about Islam. That's what Islam means. I'm pretty sure. I think the word Islam means to Allah. I'm just trying to submit to Allah. What do you say?
I had heard a similar thing. It's like when you're asking, when you're like writing an email to someone, you would like start off by praising God. So it's like praise, and then ask, and then think.
Okay, so
it's like a really, it's like establishing a relationship.
This is one option, and then we have this is the JRAD, this is the Narit option. Narit heard a shiur once. This is from Suri.
Yeah, and also, I think Ari. Yeah.
Both fine women.
Yeah.
With incredible valor.
What are those terms?
I will define them shortly. So, Narit heard a shiur, or maybe, depending on the context, it wasn't a full shiur, it was just an allegory of a very popular Gemara that seeks to define our relationship to prayer. And maybe define prayer itself, which is when one prays, one approaches the king, and when one approaches the king, there's three steps to approaching a king. One is shavach, which means praise.
You approach
the king and you say, you are awesome, and your power is unending, and your wisdom is all-knowing, and your kindness, etc. So you butter up the king, so to speak. And bakasha is, given all those things, can you do the following favors for your people or for me or for my community, etc., you know, because you're all-knowing and benevolent and so forth. And then Hodah at the end is thanks, like TIA, thanks in advance. Okay, so the Zofia Talmud can't, like, knock it completely, but, you know, whatever, who's listening to this recording? I have a problem with that. I certainly have a problem with that, at least if for no other reason than I've never met a king. It's the 21st century. We killed most of them. King Philippe is still trying to get me back to Spain after kicking out my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. Guess what, King Philippe? You can eat it. Okay. The queen mom is an inheritor of a horrifically anti-Zionistic and likely anti-Semitic royal chain. Like, okay, great. The royals announced that they're not coming to Israel until the conflict is resolved. Everywhere in the Arabian Peninsula is Beseder, except for Israel, the only democracy, because there's a conflict. Okay, that's cool. So I don't, like, have a... I've never cried when I've seen the Queen Mum. And she's still the Queen Mum. She's not... No, she passed away. Well, whatever, the Queen. I never cried when I saw the Queen. King Philippe doesn't do it for me. The king of Saudi Arabia really doesn't do it for me. So, that's A. B is this... I find this paternalistic, don't you? Say, like, we're approaching God. And I'm like, God, you're the greatest. You're really good at what you do. Has anyone told you recently?
How is that paternalistic?
Because this... God's all-powerful, all-knowing, and what the heck does God need me to butter him up?
Well, maybe it's going back to the idea that you have to recognize the greatness of God in order to connect to God.
So then who's this for?
For you.
Ah, okay, good. So someone heard a more modern take on this. So it's not for God, it's for me. But I still don't have a framework in which to plug that in. It sounds cool. It resolves only the question of paternalism. Mm-hmm. If you don't like paternalism, I take it back. Patronizing. And I'm sticking to patronizing. The notion that God needs me to butter him up, and he's not going to see the ass coming, you know? You talk to your parents, you're like, you know, I love you guys so much. I feel really close to you. Like, oh, we never hear from you. Like, I know, because I'm, like, so busy just trying to make you guys proud. Oh, like, you know, can I go to Cuba? Okay. Like, you're not going to pull that past your parents. You're going to pull that past God, which is, like, ridiculous.
Okay.
So I've always found that it's very strange, and we can flip that and say it's not for God's, for us. But I want a framework that's going to address every single point here. And the framework, and the answer has to be to a question. Right, I say this a lot, but the most irrelevant thing in the world is an answer to a question no one ever had. We have to define our questions. It's a famous. It's not like Bruce Springsteen, but a famous book called "What's Bothering Rashi?" Book series. "What's Bothering Rashi?" And the entire premise of the book, we have it. It's over there. The entire premise of the book is like an aid to studying Rashi and the Chumash, and the main tool that you use. Is you look at Rashi, and you understand Rashi's an answer, and your job is to figure out what the question is. It's a problem that the Rishonim didn't write their questions, they only wrote their answers. You have to figure out the question, because once you figure out Rashi's question, you realize that everyone's answering that question. And then you have like a room full of differing views, and you can kind of see who's in conversation with whom. Otherwise, it's just kind of like, okay, it's a nice story. I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
It's not answering my question. So what's the question? The question is, how do I get from this word to this highfalutin idea that Shevach is for myself? What is this prayer? What is prayer? So here's a problem. Here's a big problem, is that we speak in English. We speak in English, and language is loaded. Language is loaded. Philosophers have demonstrated this. I mean, different kinds of philosophers, Derrida and Wittgenstein, that the language that we use is loaded with philosophical assumptions and cultural assumptions about the things we're saying. And the truth is that the world we live in is formed by the words we use, right? Because even if your brain is kind of not writing a novel at all times, when you see something, your brain is using the words that it knows to identify it. We've done it. Some folks in San Francisco did an amazing experiment with language in the brain. They took English speakers and Russian speakers and put them in front of a computer to test how their response time to identifying colors. So no words anywhere. Just it would be like red, a red dot here, and then orange and blue. And you'd have to click which color is closest to the main color. So red, orange, blue. Orange is closer to red, right? You click orange, and they would do that. So they had two phases of this trial. One is just that how quick can you match the colors, in which the English speakers and the Russian speakers were about the same. Now here's the catch: in Russian, light blue and dark blue are actually different colors. In English and Spanish, it's light blue and dark blue. It's not, you know, every color has a range, right? But color is really a color wheel, and we arbitrarily chop up with our language. We chop up where the one color begins and another one ends, or where one ends and the other one begins. And in Russian, they just, I don't know who, a gazillion years ago, they decided that somewhere in the middle of blue is the line, and dark blue and light blue are totally different colors. So one phase of the trial was just just identifying the colors, clicking. The other, they forced people to recite a litany of numbers, random, you know, 3.14159314, like that, just over and over again. And the purpose of doing that was to occupy people's linguistic part of their brains was now in use. So now they were identifying colors. They were identifying colors not by the names of the colors, but what they looked like. And when they weren't doing the litany, Americans or English speakers were able to connect dark blue and light blue faster than the Russians. But when they were reciting the litany, the scores evened out. Follow? Because the Russians identified dark blue and light blue, even if they weren't saying it out loud, but because they identified dark blue and light blue as different colors, as long as their linguistic part of the brain was in charge. They were behind the English speakers. But once it was occupied and everyone, like, language was removed from the picture, then they were the same. It's a really long example, but you understand how language is so powerful. Really, it occupies how we perceive the world. Mm-hmm. The word prayer is philosophically loaded. So is the word holy. So is the word God. There's all kinds of words that we use that we don't know what they mean and we get stuck. Anyone know what the word prayer means? The word prayer is from the Latin word precari. And the Latin word precari is similar to the word beg. And you can put on your Shakespeare hat for a second. I pray thee. Let the damsel go. Right? Old English. Well, not really old English. Victorian English. You could say, I pray thee. What does I pray thee mean? You mean I'm praying to you?
Beg you.
I beg you. That's what prayer means. Precari means. Precari is an intense way of asking something. It's not just when you ask something, it's also what's begging. Like, why don't people like to beg? Because begging is self-deprecating, intentionally, right? When you beg, you say, I am less than you. Now, please use your exalted status to bestow me with your benevolence. Okay. And that's what precari means. And once you pray precari, then you're praying with these assumptions, right? Okay. And then when you pray to God, you're saying, I'm so little.
Yeah.
I'm nothing. Mm-hmm. You're the greatest. Bestow your benevolence on me. Is that the Jewish conception of tefillah? The first problem I'm telling you is that it doesn't matter for 99% of people because they haven't, for 99% of English speakers and Spanish speakers, because they haven't stopped to think about it. Mm. That we use the word prayer and we use the word davening and we don't think about what those words mean. So what's the Hebrew conception of tefillah? Damn it. What's the Hebrew conception of prayer called?
Tefillah.
Okay. We've played this game with precari. What's the game with tefillah? What does the word tefillah mean? So we have a rule. It's not a rule, it's not like a hard and fast rule, but we have a rule nonetheless that when we're trying to identify a word, the best use of our time is to find how it's used first in Tanakh. Because all of our Hebrew words are derived from things that happen in Tanakh, so we should see it in context. Here. Coming up in a couple of parshas, okay? Yaakov comes down to Egypt and sees his son, his beloved son that he thought was dead for 20 years. He mourns for 20 years. And he sees his son and he comes to live with him. It's really it's the end of a beautiful story. And towards the end of chapter 27, verse 28, Vayichi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim sheva esra shana, vayihi yimei Yaakov shnei chayav sheva shanim ve'arbaim imat shana. So Yaakov's life, so Yaakov lived another 27 years in Egypt, and he lived, how many years? 147 years. That's how he died when he was 147. Vayikrivu yimei Yisrael lamut. And now he was coming close to dying. And he calls out to Yosef, if I found favor in your eyes, swear to me. Nope, it's exactly, okay. Okay, so he says, swear to me, take me, you'll take my bones to be buried in Canaan. I don't want to be buried in Egypt. It's a good request. Then the beginning of chapter 38, and then after that was settled, he tells Joseph, your father is sick. I'm dying. Very Jewish. I'm dying. So Joseph brings his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim with him, meaning Yaakov's grandchildren. And And he says to Jacob, he says, your son Joseph is coming to you. And he draws close to Israel, who's on the bed, to Jacob. Jacob, Israel, same person. Vayomer Yaakov el Yosef, El Shaddai. This is chapter 38, verse 3. Okay, tell me if this doesn't bring tears to your eyes. Vayomer Yaakov, Jacob says, El Yosef to Joseph, El Shaddai nira elai, beluz, be'eretz kanan ve'erechoti. God appeared to me in Luz, and he blessed me. I am going to bless you, and I'm going to expand you, and you're going to have many children, and this land will be yours for your children forever. And now the two sons who were born to you in Egypt, they will be like my sons. I'm sorry, I thought it was like closer to the beginning of the speech. So he's recalling the death of Rachel and his hardships. Now he sees the boys and he says, who are these boys? The ones he just declared are my sons. He's old, he's close to dying. He says, these are my sons. So Yaakov says, bring them to me and I will bless them. Here's the line. Okay. I was telling you a nice story. Verse 11. Vayomer Yisrael Yosef. Israel says to Joseph, Ro'o panecha lo pilalti, v'hine hera uti Elohim gam etzarecha. Ro'o panecha, to see your face, lo pilalti. I did not pilal. V'hine hera uti Elohim gam etzarecha. 38:11. Pilalti, to see your face, lo pilalti. And here I see, and here God has shown me also your children. It's a beautiful line. I mourned you. I thought you were dead. And here you are. And I never imagined. I thought you died as a boy. And here you are a father. Ro panecha lo pilalti. Ro panecha lo pilalti. Here we have it.
To see. There's a connection to see your face, right?
So it's like this, re'opanecha, to see your face, lo pilalti, I did not blank, and here God showed me your children. This is the Hebrew phrase where pilalti appears. Okay. This is the word pilal, the word for tila, appears here.
Okay.
Does it mean to daven? If you had to fill in the blank, forget that you know that pilalti is from the word tila. If you had to fill in the blank, what's the blank? To see your face, I did not. What's the opposite of despair?
Joy.
To see your face, I did not joy.
I did not
Rejoice.
Rejoice.
I did not rejoice. No. Yaakov despaired that Yosef was dead.
Yeah.
And now he found out he was wrong, and that Yosef has children.
And I couldn't believe it. I did not imagine.
I did not
imagine.
I did not imagine. I did not hope in my wildest dreams. Pilalti means to imagine. Isn't that fascinating? That's not a midrash. That's Tanakh. The word pilal means to dream up, to conceive, to form a world around. To see your face, I did not imagine. So the question for us is, if we believe that pilal doesn't mean to pray, which means prakari, which means to beg. But tefillah really means pilalti, which means to imagine, to hope, to dream. How does that change how we think about prayer? And how does it influence our questions here? So, what do you do when you pray? Well, when you pray, you beg God for stuff that you need, and you're willing to make yourself low. When you imagine, dream, and hope, you don't make yourself low, quite the opposite. You make yourself great. You try to expand the realm of possibility, to push it beyond what you believed was possible. Because you don't imagine possible things. You imagine the impossible. What would the world look like if there was peace? What would the world look like if there was no hunger? What would the world look like if Israel was safe? What would the world look like if everyone had health? Imagining. Imagine the impossible. So let's jump back to our quick fix on Shevach Bekasha Hoda. That it's not buttering up God, it's buttering up ourselves. I don't disagree, but I want to plug it into a bigger framework. And the bigger framework is, if all you have is prakari and you say Shevach is for me, then so why am I begging God? I should just be begging myself. But if tefillah means to imagine, then what does Shevach Bekasha Hoda mean? Shevach, when you praise God, is you're getting yourself into a mindset where you realize that you're speaking to, oh my God, okay, let's go soon, where you're speaking to the creator of all things, the context of all things. There isn't something that exists outside of God. There isn't God, and there's me, and then there's a thing that God creates, and that's between me, him and me. No. Everything I know, everything that I am, is inside the context of God. Isn't that mind-blowing? Don't you want to think about that for a couple minutes before you ask God for stuff? So that's imagining. We're getting ourselves into a mindset, we're getting ourselves into a headspace, to sound like a 21st century yoga instructor. We're getting ourselves into a headspace where I'm realizing what I'm doing, and I'm pushing my imaginative capacities and my faculties beyond what I'm used to doing. And in that sense, tefillah is not necessarily about asking God for things, because remember, God's all good, all knowing, and all powerful. Who's not all good, all knowing, and all powerful? Me. I'm not that good. I'm kind of stupid. And in the grand scheme of things, what can I really change? But if that's in reality, if when I imagine, I have to get myself to a place that the things that I want and the things that I pray for or imagine, the things that in my wildest dreams I would love to come true are all good. Right? So now I have an overly structured Shmona Esrei that isn't what I'm asking God for, but it's actually what God's asking me to want. Shmona Esrei is the closest thing we have to an anthology of our beliefs. You could sit down and read through it. And the first three blessings are Shevach, are praising God, right? Those are our beliefs about God, about who God is, about what God is, and how we relate to God, and who are we in the context of that. Then Bakasha are things that we're asking for God. Those are the things that we're supposed to want. Those are the things that we're fighting for. Those are our mission statements. Those are our war cries. And then Hodah, thankful, I don't tell you, you guys call yourselves Jews, from the word Yehuda, from Hodah. So we, being grateful is part and parcel of the DNA of the Jew, right? So just, to walk ourselves back through all the difficulties, and I've loved this conception of tefillah, and I feel it answers really all the questions anyone could have. Belief in God? What if I don't believe in God? It doesn't matter, because you have to, when you're praying, you have to beg somebody, but when you're imagining, this is more like, it's more like a workout.
But
this is more like a workout. This is pushing our imaginative faculties as far as they can go. So if there is a God, if there isn't a God, it shouldn't keep me from praying. Because praying is almost like what people want to conceptualize that meditation is, right? It's kind of putting myself in the headspace. So hopefully there's a God. I'll still pray, though. I'll still daven 3 times a day. It's a great question. Once is enough if we're asking God, because God already knows all this stuff. But I don't know this stuff. I need this to be drilled into my head. I need to put myself in this place over and over and over and over again. And I have to make sure that all my actions align with my beliefs. So I need to remind myself of my beliefs. I need to take a moment to step out to make sure that my whole being is focused around this mission, about these things. Language barrier? I mean, we see the trouble with we see the trouble with the language barrier is real on the one hand. On the other hand, it's necessary to get ourselves around the language barrier, because we'll never truly understand what we're saying if we keep translating it. as much as I love new translations and as much as I love new explanations, you got to get to the original because you'll be missing out on everything if you're in the wrong language. Overly structured, there's room for innovation on the one hand. On the other hand, we need this kind of setting because we're so far removed. Right, tefillah wasn't always structured, right? Tefillah for sure in Tanakh is not structured at all. People just like daven for random things. But they're already plugged into this world where the things that they're davening for make sense because they know what to want. So they don't need that structure. The structure comes very late in Jewish history. It comes only, you know, some 2,000 years ago or so. They were afraid that, you know, Jews were going to be exiled and we don't know Hebrew and we don't know what to daven for anymore. We don't know what to daven for because we're leaving Israel. So outside of it, once you're out, you know, when you build a Jewish commonwealth in Israel, and then everyone's exiled, so what do you rally your national identity around? This is, we could talk about this so much longer. But think about it, you're still Jewish 2,000 years later. We haven't had a country to live in. We haven't had a shared common language. Think about the impact of a shared Shemona Esrei means. We all believe in the same thing. We're all asking for the same thing 3 times a day. 3 times a day, every Jew in the world is pointed to Jerusalem. Is it a miracle that we came back in 1948? Or was it 2,000 years of good planning, of laying the groundwork, that even we get to a point where Jews who were so distant from Judaism had so ingrained in their hearts and souls that it's part of who we are, is to go back to Israel. Even they didn't daven anymore, but it was so buried in the DNA of the Jew. It's 3 times a day. Today, return us to Jerusalem. You come back to Jerusalem. Can't talk about this without deism, determinism. That'll take too long. But I feel like you have the tools now. So just to recap, we have all sorts of dilemmas around prayer, such as like, what if I don't believe in God, or what if I do believe in God, and I believe that God's all good and all knowing and all powerful. I don't need to ask Him for these things. He already knows all these things. And why 3 times a day, once a day, overly structured? We have all these difficulties, and the something we realize is the word prayer is from the word prakari, which means to beg. The other version of pray, like I pray you, I pray thee, and to beg means to like lower yourself. But the way tefillah, the word pilel, is used in a context where it's not obviously davening. So it's not going to, like, you know, like, oh, what does tefillah mean? Oh, it means tefillah. In a non-tautological place, pilalti means to hope, imagine, dream, and that completely reconceptualizes what tefillah means for us. It means we're pushing our imaginative faculties to conceptualize things that we want to be true, and we're also teaching ourselves what it is that we want. We're embedding in ourselves and ingraining ourselves what it is we want. Questions?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, well, it's been an awesome semester, and God willing, next semester we'll pick up with Sfarim Sofrim. I doubt we're going to meet next week, finals and whatnot. Everything falls apart around then.
I'll be home by then, actually.
Ah, there we go.